The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Smith, could you move the minutes?
Has the date been amended, Chair?
What we'll do is if you move them, then we'll fix them and then we'll pass them on.
Okay, I move to fix then.
Okay, so Representative Smith moves the minutes. And we're going to amend two items on there. One is where it says the date March 10th, it should be March 12th. So we will amend that for the record. And then on the upper right, 38th, we will correct the spelling of 8th. So with those two, Representative Smith moves the minutes as amended. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Smith. Okay, we have a full agenda for today. We will go in order. So the first bill we have before us is House File 238. Representative Johnson, if you could join us at the table there. And so Representative Johnson will move House File 238. And I do not believe there's any amendments. Okay, Representative Johnson, if you could please, you move the bill. If you could please describe it, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chair, members. House File 238 clarifies how interest is calculated on municipal special assessments and requires refunds when property owners are charged more interest than accrued, ensuring taxpayers are not overcharged on maintaining local government ability to finance improvements. Basically, what this does, it turns these kind of loans, you know, many people have experienced assessments as a result of road improvements. And so they can either pay it up front or they can put it on their property taxes and make payments. And right now, if it is put on your property taxes, if the interest is calculated in it, and if you pay it off early, you don't receive a refund of that interest. Well, that's kind of unusual. If you do any other kind of loans, if you pay it off early, you benefit from saving interest. What this will do is they will fix that and require a payment back to the citizen who is assessed if they pay it off early, a year earlier, whatever that is. So that is my bill.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, the chairman was remiss. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. I have no Irish in me, so I don't have a green tie. But in honor, I've got my green beads. So just for the record. Okay, so is there anyone? I see you have a witness, and we'll go right to the witness. But is there anyone else that has not signed up that would like to testify to House File 238? Okay, if you would please state your name for the record and who you represent, sir.
Sure. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak today. My name is Clifford Bougeau. I live in Lake Elmo, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. So my streets were rehabilitated in my neighborhood under a pavement management program in 2024. During this process, I learned that a homeowner who pays off or pays down principal on an assessment following certification to county property tax rolls is charged interest for a full year as permitted today by state statute. Here's an example, very basic. In 2025, a municipality assesses each homeowner $10,000. The homeowner opts to let the assessment certify to property taxes. And each November, as I understand it, if there's an outstanding assessment balance, that certification occurs. The municipality approved an annual interest rate of 6%. That equals $600 on the $10,000 assessment. In March of 2026, 6 months later, the property owner receives a bonus from their employer or, for tax reasons, opts to withdraw investment funds. The homeowner pays down but not off their assessment by $5,000. Under today's statute, $600 is credited to interest with this payment and $4,400 would be credited to principal. The remaining amount owed under today's calculation would be $5,600. If the municipality were using simple interest calculations, interest would have been calculated at $300 to March 20, 26 at the time the payment was made. $4,700 would have been credited to principal versus $4,400. And the remainder owed would be $5,300, not $5,600. The property owner makes no other principal reductions in 2026. The municipality recertifies the remaining assessment balance of $5,600 to the county and assesses interest at 6%. This is, of course, the following year. That equals $336. If simple interest calculations were used, interest at 6% would be applied to the $5,300 balance, equaling $318, not $336. In March of 2027, the homeowner pays off the assessment. Under current statute, the payoff would be $5,936. Under simple interest calculations, the payoff would be $5,459. The homeowner has paid $477 more interest under current statute and practice. Some of you might be aware that bonds are issued by local municipalities when street improvements and utility improvements are made. Investors in these bonds are deemed to be knowledgeable and intelligent and additionally prudent. Prepayments and yield risk is something they very much understand. So that should not stand in the way of anyone voting to change this particular statute. Simple technology involving amounts assessed, amounts paid, elapsed time and days, and daily interest accrual factors can be brought to bear on this particular situation at a detailed level. In summary, and this is, these kinds of things, these calculations have been going on for decades in the financial institution services world in the private sector. They are very familiar with having to do this from a legal perspective. Excuse me. In summary, excuse me again, state law must not enable or justify an unjust practice. The law should not make public practices of interest collection legal when it is illegal in the private sector. Therefore, changes to the assessment statute are necessary and imperative to achieve what's right and fair for the citizen being assessed. That is, I conclude my comments, and again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and present.
Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. We will go to, first of all, just to make sure there's no one else in the audience would like to testify for the bill or with concerns. Would the department like to testify on it? Can't till noon? Okay. Member questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question to the testifier or the author of the bill. Just kind of as we're looking at this, is this something that actually happens, or is this something that's more theoretical for possibility? Mm-hmm. Like, have you some real examples where this has been done?
I have not experienced this personally, but I was made specifically aware that it does happen pursuant to my experience in the latest round of our street being improved in 2024. I was specifically discussing it with our city's finance director, and she said, yes, this happens.
Okay. Chair Swazinski. Representative Hewitt.
Just trying to read up on this real quick, but Mr. Chair, to Representative Johnson, with your experience in county commissioner before this, just curious, is this common that when you do an assessment like this, and maybe I misunderstood it, and I'm real simple about this stuff, and it might put me back on the JV, but the truth of the matter is that if you do an assessment like this and there's interest, or not really interest, there's a bond, right? The bond has a certain amount of interest paid. Can the cities and counties make money off that, charging up the interest on it to the homeowner? I'm just curious. I'm lost.
Representative Johnson. Or to the testifier.
Said he could speak on this specifically.
Please do,
Mr.
Sir.
Chair.
So again, I don't have detailed personal experience with the associated bonds to such a project. I would imagine the bond indenture currently as it's written would, A, indicate that there are fixed principal and interest payments to the investor. However, I would also imagine that the bond indenture also indicates that fluctuations may occur and there's no guarantees. Again, my comment back to what bond investors being knowledgeable, prudent, intelligent, understanding prepayment risk, understanding yield risk. So that's what I'm able to share.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, maybe staff can enlighten me on this. Is that a common practice when we bond something that we levied against someone's taxes to pay us, do we up the interest rate that we were charged?
Do we have someone from House Research could help us, Mr. Pope?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, as I understand the question, it's whether the local governments can charge interest at a rate in excess of the interest rate on the bond such that they're profiting off of the interest charge. And that constitutionally, there needs to be a reasonable relationship between the interest being charged on a special assessment and the interest rate that the city is incurring in the bonds or however else it might be structuring the debt that it's incurring in the project.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have a lot of questions about this, but not to be answered here, that I'm going to have to research myself. I don't believe the government should be a bank and should be yielding money off of bonding that, you know, I just have some issues with this. So that's a more of a personal statement, Mr. Chair. And thanks for the endowment, and I hope you'll keep me in the play.
To the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To clarify what the other representative was mentioning about the interest rate that is assessed to the homeowner and their assessment, in my particular situation and our local municipality, the interest rate assessed was 1% above the bond rate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's customary across municipalities, but that's what was done for our particular bond issue when our streets were done in 2024.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you to the testifier, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, like I said, I know there's probably fees associated with this about floating the debt or whatever, but I'm just still confused. But I thank the testifier. We should move on.
Any other questions from members? Would you like to wrap it up, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chair, members. This basically is just, I just want to let you know I did check in with our local entities, both Cottage Grove and Lake Elmo mayors, and they said they had no issue with this. This isn't something that they totally understood, and they were kind of, in fact, one of them was like, really? We don't? So this wasn't something that's going to affect. There is no fiscal note because it's not going to affect us down here, and it's really not an amount that would affect any of the cities. I just do know it's an amount that, you know, as we're working on affordability, and every dollar counts. If you pay off your loan or your assessment early, you should be able to benefit from getting that interest back. So thank you for your consideration today.
Thank you very much, Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 238 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, and thank you to your witness. Item next, we will go to House File 3381, Representative Johnson. And I do believe we have one witness, looks like. Okay, Representative Johnson moves House File 3381. Just a little lay of the land here. I know we have one witness. Is there anyone else from the audience, from the public, would like to testify on this bill? Okay, we'll go to your opening testimony and then member questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair, co-chair, and members. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm presenting today House File 3381, which adds clarifying language to existing laws exempting nonprofit prepared meals programs from the state sales tax. This was something that was in place a number of years ago, and the reason that we're before you today is there was a new reading or understanding of the way the bill is, and I could go into detail, but I'll leave that to our testifier. But the bottom line is prepared food that is, you know, the difference out in the I guess, real world, the difference between going to a grocery store and buying raw material, raw food, and preparing it yourself, as opposed to buying something that is prepared. One is charged sales tax and one is not. In the past, there was an understanding that when there was a nonprofit to a nonprofit, if there was prepared, it would still not be sales tax because of the purpose that's doing. There was a reading of that bill, of that law, and the new understanding was that it should be taxed. What we're here is trying to fix that, and the reason is because it amounts to up to about $600,000 to $700,000 that is being taxed, which is now resulting in less food and less going out to people who are using the food shelves and also where the prepared food is going. So this bill is really addressing that so we can be more efficient in making sure we get the food out to those that need. And I will pass it off to our testifier.
Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. My name is Angelica Bravo-Klevish. I'm the Director of Community Partnerships and Investment at Second Harvest Heartland, and I'm here in support of House File 3381. Second Harvest Heartland launched the Kitchen Coalition Prepared Meals Program in March of 2020. We bring together restaurants, caterers, and hunger-fighting organizations to tackle hunger and service sector layoffs brought on by the pandemic. Our program provides prepared meals to respond to the surge in hunger and see communities through to recovery. We estimate that about 15% of food insecure individuals are unable to use raw material, as the representative said. Today, Kitchen Coalition chefs cook for neighbors who may not have the home health or ability to cook the groceries that food shelves offer. Meals are then distributed by partner nonprofits who work with individuals and families experiencing inconsistent access to a kitchen. They also support people with challenges caused by physical mobility issues or illness, or those who are managing a crisis, challenge, or time of transition. Partner kitchens receive 50% of the ingredients and all packaging for these meals from Second Harvest Heartland, along with a reimbursement for the labor. Kitchen partners aren't making any profit on Kitchen Coalition meals. They're part of this coalition because they care about their neighbors. In June 2025, as the representative mentioned, Second Harvest Heartland was informed by the Minnesota Department of Revenue that we would need to begin paying taxes, sales taxes, on meals as of July 1, 2025. This is a significant and unexpected expense of $50,000 to $60,000 per month for a program that serves our core mission of providing food for hungry Minnesotans. Currently, statute includes exemptions for meals going to children and seniors. However, Kitchen Coalition serves Minnesotans of all ages experiencing barriers to cooking. Kitchen Coalition has been forced to make the difficult decision to decrease the number of meals going into our communities as a result. This legislation will provide a fix, exempting prepared meals when they are purchased and distributed in performance of our mission of ending hunger together. This will enable those dollars to go directly toward meals for hungry neighbors. Please support this bipartisan legislation and the thousands of Minnesotans who count on this program for their next meal. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
No, thank you, and thank you for what your organization does. Very, very, very important. Questions for members? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I am reading the bill language here, and I'm just wondering if this applies only to nonprofits like Second Harvest, whose, you know, sole purpose is like a food bank and feeding folks, or would it apply to other nonprofits that have food distribution in addition to like sports programs and other other programs?
Okay, good question. Maybe House Research could handle that. We'll give it a shot. Ms. Hagler, sorry. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, I think based on the language and how it's written, I think that would be up to the department for interpretation, but I think that the assumptions made in the revenue estimate and the way the language is right now, that it would be that the nonprofit sole mission would need to be the furnishing of food.
Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I was also looking at the revenue note, and it seemed a little bit unclear because it seemed like those assumptions are a little bit different than what the bill language says. And so I don't know if – I think we're laying this bill over, right?
Yes.
Are we laying the bill over?
I'm sorry.
So.
I thought you were asking Ms. Templin if she's laying it over. So, yes, we would be laying it
over. We've upgraded Ms. Templin today. Very good. So I think just maybe clarity on how this exemption would be applied would be helpful, because I think that that would probably change the revenue note.
Thank you very much. And we will, Ms. Templin, we will work on that. Does the department wish to enter this discussion at all? Yeah. Why don't you let us know? I'm not sure just, you know, how we went from it's not taxable to it is taxable. Please state your name, who rips them for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Revenue. And Mr. Chair, it is limited to the nonprofit that sole purpose is to do prepared food, but we can always look to see if we can like tighten it up a little bit to make sure it only applies to the authors group or the group that they're intending to, it to apply to.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And I would just say, I mean, there are also other nonprofits out there that, you know, are larger, so they have capacity to do food distribution in addition to other programs. And I imagine those nonprofits would want to be up here getting the same exemption. And so just want to put a plug in for that. I won't name some of those orgs, but we know that they do exist in Minnesota. So
thank you. Chair Gomez.
Yeah, thank you. I support the intent of this bill. I do think that the on 2.31, just saying like in it talks about the prepared food being distributed in the performance of the organization's exempt purpose. I would imagine that if I were like, you know, if I ran a kids program or kind of, you know, there are other like sort of non-food or hunger related exempt purposes that if I were them, I would probably be trying to get an exemption to this too. So as we move forward, I just think we should maybe like look at, figuring out if that is sort of too broad for what the intent of this is. But thank you.
No, thank you, Chair Gomez. And Representative Lee, very good point there. I think we might need to tighten that up a little bit, Representative Johnson. Okay, any other questions from members? If not, Representative Johnson moves that House File 3381 be laid over for possible inclusion. Oh, I'm sorry. You want to wrap the bill up there, Representative Johnson? You did such a good job, I really didn't think you needed to. But so,
thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members. Thank you for bringing up those, and I do look forward to working with you as we work on this to get it to what the intent is. Bottom line is the intent is and where it was to get it back to where it was where we could, before it started taking another $50,000 to $60,000 out a month, that was then reducing the meals that could get out there. We all talked about the different bills and how we can help those with the hunger issue, those that are the different shelves and different programs. So we're just trying to get it back to where the original intent was. And if we're working together, we can tighten it up so we can achieve that goal. That would be great. Thank you.
And thank you to the chief author of House File 3381. Thank you to your witness. We do need to get this taken care of because rather than sending Department of Revenue, who we love dearly, I'd rather send it to folks that need the service. So with that, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 3381 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thank you to your witness. Okay, let's go to the next item, which would be Representative Joy, House File 3754. Are there amendments on that one? Okay, very good. Representative Joy moves House File 3754, two-year bill. Vice Chair Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a tax conformity bill to moving the Trump accounts, removing the law that excludes from gross income up to $2,500 for employer contributions to the Trump accounts. And I just think this is one of those bills that has very little fiscal cost and something we should move forward with conforming to the federal government.
Okay, thank you very much, Vice Chair Joy. Do you have any witnesses at all, or is anyone in the audience like to, in the public, would like to testify? Okay. Member questions? Okay, would you like to wrap your bill up, Representative Joy?
I appreciate having the time for this bill today and looking forward to it beating the tax bill at the end of the year. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Joy renews his motion that House File 3754 be included in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Joy, and I see you're up there with all your friends. Okay. So, sorry. Okay, we're going to have the DE 4 amendment distributed, which should be the correct one for the Ryer bill. And Representative Ryer is on her way. She's been down in bonding committee. So. I'll give you this one. Want this one?
Trade.
Okay. Yeah.
You have the real stuff, so I have to.
You get the fake stuff. You know, since we're still
redistribution.
Do you want to say if you're not ready, that's fine. Okay, we're going to go, members, we're going to go to Chair Gomez for an update on what happens on Wednesday. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So tomorrow we're going to do something a little bit different than normal tax committee fare. We're going to hear about the issues facing the Hennepin County Medical Center. And so we're going to hear from the hospital directly. We have a presentation about some of the issues facing hospitals across the state, which are sort of being seen most acutely at HCMC right now, but impact other, you know, the entire medical system. You know, this is because I think, as most of us know, there is, you know, HCMC is facing really existential financial threats. It is an important statewide asset, and we have to do something to help them. So thanks for letting me go on a little bit while we're waiting for Liz Ryer.
We're filibustering here.
We're filibustering.
Yes.
I could keep it. No, I'm
but, but to your point, Chair Gomez, thank you for having this hearing tomorrow. It will be a very, very important hearing. HCMC North Memorial, very, very important to the entire state. So I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say. And I also have to make a disclaimer. Yesterday on the House floor when we were talking about the PTE bill, Representative Anderson was actually correct. I was reading off the thing said 2.1. You were correct. So that was hard to say for me.
But we loved you we were right. See that.
Chair, that doesn't mean you were wrong.
No, you aren't wrong.
It doesn't make me a bad person.
No.
No. No. It was around the year.
It was just around.
1.5 billion.
Oh, Mr. Chair. I didn't mention that we are going to North Memorial will also be present tomorrow, and so they'll be sharing for a few minutes too. I forgot.
Thank you. Professor Anderson.
Can I ask revenue on a
question? Yes, revenue. You just stay there. We're kind
of Representative, saved by the bell.
We're semi in recess.
Can I?
Let's go to the bill and we'll talk after.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm going to put you on the list here, Representative Anderson. Now that we have Representative Ryer, and she's very busy here too. So. Representative Ryer, I will move House File 1049 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. You have three wonderful witnesses to talk to us today. If you could please present your bill, and then we'll go in order. Angela Forlin from my alma mater, Spring Valley Wolves, Katrina Taylor, and then Lori Groth. We're excited to hear from those three. But to your bill, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a DE 4 amendment.
Would you like to do that to get the bill in shape you'd like? Okay, members, I will move the H1049 DE 4 amendment. Any questions for members? Any testifiers? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended in the shape the author would like. Two-year bill, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, members. House File 1049, as amended by the DE4, directs the Legislative Budget Office to collect information from school districts on the details of the health insurance plans they're offering their employees. 9 out of 10 schools are experiencing staffing shortages, and the high cost of health insurance is a driver of that statistic. This year started with 3,200 teachers in Anoka-Hennepin, the largest school district in the state, on the verge of a strike. The big issue wasn't working conditions or salaries, it was spiraling health insurance costs. One teacher told reporters his premium had jumped 22% in a single year. He was paying $1,000 a month just to keep his family covered. But escalating healthcare costs are not just a problem for large districts. In Spring Valley, a sixth grade teacher at Kingsland Public School with 44 teachers, 500 students, said it plainly when her carrier announced a major rate hike. Either I get insurance or I get a paycheck. The same story is playing out in Blooming Prairie, Stuartville, Casson Manorville, Pine Island, and many more districts. House File 1049 will help the legislature understand the statewide impact health insurance increases are having on our school district budgets. The survey will provide district-level data about employees and potential enrollees, plan offerings and actuarial values, and plan financials such as district and employee expenditures as it relates to health insurance. This committee is charged with being stewards of our tax dollars, and we need to be asking ourselves questions around how much of our public money is going to the people that are being covered and how much is flowing directly to health insurance companies and insurance brokers. This bill will help us answer those questions, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you for hearing my bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. Let's go right in. Any member questions right now? Or let's take the test. Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I do have a question. Maybe it's would this include the benefits provided? Because we know there are certain things that are really big cost drivers that have been happening recently, like GLP-1 drugs and those sort of things have actually. So I'm just wondering if this includes the benefit structure.
Representative Ryer.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. My understanding, my belief is that it does. I'm just going to the list here, but it includes the plan design, the in-network deductibles, out-of-pocket limits. And to me, for this to be useful, it needs to be breaking it down. Mm-hmm.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So I think it's good. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay, let's go right down the list here. Number one, Angela Forlin. Number two, Katina Taylor. Number three, Lori Goth. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Angela Forlin. I am a fifth, sixth grade language arts and reading teacher in Kingsland Public Schools. I am testifying in support of HF 1049. A year ago today, my dad passed away from pancreatic cancer. As the oldest, I was always the responsible one. So as the responsible one, I am here as a member of my local union to tell our story. Kingsland is a small district in rural southeast Minnesota. We are close to Mayo Clinic, and we would appear to be lucky as there is healthcare clinics close by and the district offers insurance. However, I'm here to tell you that being so close to Mayo is actually detrimental to us. As a district with less than 100 full-time teachers and staff, very few insurance companies will even look to offer us or consider us high risk due to being such a small pool. Our district was with PEEP for many years, as that was our only option because no other carriers would even on the private market would even insure us. We do appreciate the ability to participate in PEEP, but over the years, brokers have enticed several of the low claim groups out of the pool, leaving our pool too top heavy with more high claim districts, which has increased or created instability within the pool. The legislative passed some much needed stability measures to PEEP, but over the years, we've had our insurance premiums rise every year, sometimes by as much as 15%. This last year, our premiums were to increase by 20%. Let me put that into perspective for you. Family plans in our district cost members over $3,200 a month in premiums alone. What that meant for our members was the following. Members had to make the choice between getting a paycheck and not taking the insurance, or taking the insurance and not be able to use it because there was no money left to cover the extra insurance costs after paying the premiums. Or they would use the insurance that costs more than their salary and pay the district back at the end of the year. Having Mayo in our backyard means that we cannot go to a clinic that is less than a level 4, which increases our cost coverage when we do go, which is more expensive. So even if we do have insurance, we frequently can't afford to use it. The taxpayers of Minnesota who are funding school district budgets need to understand the full implications of this brokerage system. HF 1049 will gather vital information on how much districts are spending on health care across the state to help inform a solution to the problem, such as statewide health insurance pool for all educators. I do encourage or urge your support of HF 1049.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll do the other two testifiers and have everybody up there so members could ask questions. So Katina Taylor, Lori Goth, can we get?
Yes.
Yes, if we, okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. I think we'll go through the testimony, then we'll have member questions.
Sure. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katina Taylor, and I am a special educational assistant of 28 years and serving as the president for our ESP chapter of Minneapolis Federation of Educators, Local 59. I am here today to express my support for HF 1049. Educational support professionals are the first people students greet in the morning and the last educators they see in the afternoon. ESPs are predominantly women and the most racially diverse group of adults in nearly every school. We are the tutors, the special educational aides, and the hall monitors. We keep buildings clean, we serve the food, and have the most trusted relationships with students. Unfortunately, we also have fewer job protections than teachers. When it comes to accessing health insurance, what we are offered is too expensive compared to our take-home wages. None of the plans we are offered meet the cost of living average in the county we work in because the cost of the premium is 30% of our take-home pay. That's too expensive for us to afford. My family picked what we thought was the lower cost plan. And this plan is still very expensive, ranging from $700 to $1,000 a month. God forbids anyone else gets sick in my family. The co-pays and deductibles break the bank every time. While it's true ESPs have made some financial progress thanks to increases in school funding from the state, we're still struggling. It doesn't matter how much heart, care, support, and love we bring to work for students, we can't win at this game. Even when we're working extra jobs, it's too much. We need to see some relief to this statewide program now, to this problem. But first, we need to understand the scope of this problem. This bill does not create new reporting systems for districts. Districts maintain about 95% of this data. HF 1049 simply requires this information to be reported consistently statewide so the public can see how the cost of health insurance impacts Minnesota's public schools. Without clear data, it is nearly impossible to understand the full scope of the problem or evaluate solutions. Without this data, any statewide health insurance plan will be based on guesswork. With it, Minnesota can seriously explore long-term strategies like a statewide health insurance pool for all public school employees. Please, please, please support HF 1049. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Ms. Goth.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Lori Goth, and I am a special education para for the St. Michael Albertville School District. I provide academic support in general education classes, and I run a resource room where students can come to get extra help. There was a time when education support professional jobs were sought after because of the good pay and great benefits. But after 25 years of underfunding by the state of Minnesota, our wages and benefits have not kept up, and positions like mine are hard to fill. When bargaining, the district comes to the table, says, "This is your budget, wages or health insurance." Not everyone takes the insurance, but everyone takes the wages. So the insurance gets more expensive and the plans get worse. After decades of disinvestment, my insurance is, well, it's bad. I'd like to be able to tell you about my son. One day he woke up and couldn't see out of his right eye. After many appointments with many doctors and specialists, and patiently, also known as agonizingly, waiting for test results and numerous MRIs, we found out he has a rare eye disease. It took a year, but the doctors found a way to stabilize it. Unfortunately, our insurance will not cover the medication the doctor actually prescribed. Instead, we are forced to use a medication that is for children with cancer who are waiting to have a bone marrow transplant. It suppresses the immune system and has possibly devastating and irreversible long-term side effects. He needs to be on this for at least 3 years and possibly forever. This medication isn't covered by insurance either, but it's $168 a month out of pocket rather than $7,000. I work 3 jobs to pay for medical expenses, and my son may still lose his sight. Imagine telling your child that you can't afford to keep them healthy. I don't want to be just one more sad story, thank you. But I do want to put a face to a statewide problem. ESPs in every district in our state are struggling to care for our families. This is a statewide problem, and it needs a statewide solution. This report will help us understand the full scope of the problem and what it would take to provide us with the kind of health insurance that would allow us to care for our kids at school and also our families at home. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for members? If not, Representative Lee.
Sorry, I'm too short. So I will be sure to raise my hand higher next time. I just want to thank Representative Ryer for her fight to continue to make sure that we have, even basic sustainable health care for our ESPs. Just want to share a little of my story. My mom is still an ESP. She's been an ESP for 30 years. And we were never on her health plan because it was too expensive, because she wasn't paid enough. And the health care would have been too expensive if our family was on it. And so all the kids were always on my dad's health plan. So thank you for this fight. I mean, it's been going on for 30 plus years. I hope eventually there will be a resolution. So this report is a very small step, but a good first step. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryan. Thank you to the folks testifying and sharing your lived experience. I work as a para during the interim, haven't been able to this last year, but I know the struggles that you find with trying to make ends meet on the salary as well as being able to access health care when many of the districts don't provide it for our ESPs or keep the amounts of hours you work below the ability to qualify for health care. We all know the system is broken. A lot of our districts have been talking about the rising costs of health care, like you said, for decades. And what's been even harder for our districts is when you have a smaller school and then you have catastrophic health experiences within that pool. We benefit here from CGIP. My husband's been a teacher for over 30 years, and when I started working here first as staff, we quickly switched over to our health insurance here because it was so much cheaper than what was offered by his district. Having the right data, because every district is so different when they go to the bargaining table, what has been done over the years, as Representative Anderson pointed out, what kind of policies they provide. It's really important to collect this data so that we can make a better decision to fix a problem that's been around for 3 decades. So thank you.
Okay, let's go to Representative Smith.
thank you, Chair. Thank you, testifiers, for testifying, and Representative Ryer for bringing this bill. This is incredibly important. As the testifier from Fillmore County pointed out, southeastern Minnesota, where I live, pays the highest in premiums across the board. We receive excellent health care, but the premiums are very, very expensive. And I know my school board when they received an influx in funding in 2023. Almost all of it during the union negotiation went to paying increased premiums. So most teachers in my district, if you talk to them, didn't see an actual pay increase. They just were able to keep their health care as health care costs were rising. So this is critically important for us to have a larger pool. It's basic logic in insurance that a larger pool redistributes the risk and the premium distribution so that eventually our teachers will have affordable health care across the board, less teachers having jobs on the weekends to actually pay their bills, and then the job they're passionate about during the week to get the great benefits is just not a society any of us want to live in. So thank you for this bill. Thank you for those who have supported it. And I hope this is the first step in eventually getting to a place where all of our teachers have affordable, consistent costs when they get health care.
I'll be going to Chair Gomez to wrap up. Any other member questions before we go to Chair Gomez? Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Ryer and all of the testifiers who've joined us today. We really appreciate you being here. And to the chair for hearing this. I think that we've had a good discussion about the stakes of this. I guess I, you know, since we're the tax committee, I want to draw our attention back to the state and local fiscal relationship, which is a topic of discussion in our committee frequently. Because what we know is that when we at the state over decades often, in this case certainly, of with education funding, when we underfund critical local services, obviously our people don't get the services that they deserve. Our workers are not getting the working conditions that they deserve. Their families are impacted. But also our property taxes go up. And so when we're talking about education funding, we just really have to understand the very direct relationship between our choices here at the state and the decisions that we put on to, you know, to local school districts in this case, local school boards and superintendents and leaders who have to make those difficult decisions. And so as we talk about what the drivers of increasing property taxes are, which we've heard bipartisan concern from, which we hear from our communities all the time, you know, we've heard, we have discussed that relationship between our funding to local governments and increasing property tax levies, and we have the same issue is impacting these systems. So, you know, our, as we have, you know, as a percentage of our state budget, as we've funded schools, local governments less and less, especially since there was were these huge cuts in 2002, and we haven't really ever gotten back up to that level, proportionate to our state revenues and our state budgets. We're just putting these decisions onto other people. The bills have to get paid, but everybody loses, and we are forcing our local governments to use, you know, property tax levies. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we were going to wrap it up with Chair Gomez, but Representative Elkins.
Hi. Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize, but I just occurred to me to ask, why do we think that Representative Ryers, the original bill, 2904, would have a really big fiscal note?
Ms. Templin? Or who should be our answer?
Maybe ask Ryer, because they don't have
you. Oh, you want to have the last person, Ryer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. For me, this is why we have this bill, because we want to understand what the fiscal implications are and what the design needs to be, so it's premature to answer that question from my point of view.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Elkins.
That's fine, thanks.
Okay. Would you like to wrap it up? But first of all, thank you to the three testifiers. I really appreciate the testimony. If you want to wrap it up, Representative Ryer, and then we will lay it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all, and a special thanks to the testifiers. It's hard to come here and share such deep and personal experiences, and yet your stories are what drives the need for these policy changes. So thank you very much, and thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you very much. So, Representative, I will move that House File 1049 as amended be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Can revenue?
Yes, revenue. Could you join us here? And the reason I'm talking about the revenue things and Ms. Bears being able to talk is that I believe at noon the governor's tax bill will be unveiled, so I'm looking forward to that, mm-hmm. I think. And then Chair Gomez and I will work out hearing it, and I always promise whoever the governor is to hear the tax bill, so with a full testimony from the Department of Revenue and others. Okay, to Ms. Bears.
Thank you.
Hi.
I just have a question. So we've had a lot of discussion about the pass-through entity tax and the fact that we don't have it for this year. So the 15th, 2 days ago, was the deadline for business taxes, and normally they would pay their first quarter estimates at that time. You know, you'd get that from your accountant. So now that that's not happening, April 15th, those business owners, 66,000 some odd business owners, will have to pay estimates personally for their state taxes for their companies. Now, if this body doesn't pass the PTE before April 15th, but does pass it before we end session, so sometime after that, how does revenue handle refunding those dollars to individuals that are paying individually on April 15th because they're required to, but actually wants to elect to do the PTE, so they'd have to back pay and make up that, that missed payment in March. So how does revenue handle that? Is it actually not refunded until they file their taxes a year from now, or how is that done? Thank you,
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So the PTE tax follows the S corp and the partnership. So the estimated tax due is April 15th. Mm-hmm. What the March 15th date is the date that they have to file their return for last year, mm-hmm. and pay any remaining amount due. Mm-hmm. So without the PTE, the individual then files an estimated tax on the April 15th date, and they have to pay the 90% or last year's tax liability in order not to get additional tax charge. Mm-hmm. If there's no PTE, then the PTE wouldn't file their estimated taxes on April 15th. Mm-hmm. So if this passes in May, then it would just really be the PTE that has the estimated payment that would be missed. It wouldn't be the individual, because they're going to be just paying what they paid last year. And so there's a couple different options that you could do. You could say, we're going to waive the ATC charge for the PTE entity. Or you could say that the first estimated payment for the PTE would not be due, or would be due at the same time the second payment is due. So there's a different approach. For administration, we can either, it doesn't, we don't have a position on it. We can do it in May or June, or we could do it now. There's just, it would be very similar.
I think, members, what we should do is we should have this when we go over the governor's bill. We'll have plenty of time to ask questions at Representative Anderson, is that okay?
Sure. I just think it needs to. We're running up against another deadline, and we're telling business owners they have to pay twice and not get essentially a refund till a year from now if we don't do this. So,
I'm looking for Representative Anderson. Mm-hmm.
We don't give guidance to. Okay.
Let's move on here. This is not, as my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Blakesley, taught me when I was acting up, she'd say, and maybe you can, Ms. Foreland, I don't know if you've heard Mrs. Blakesley, she'd say, Gregory, today is not the day. Okay? There will be a day. A day. There will be a day. So let's, and we'll be talking about that a lot. We'll see what the governor has to say about moving that forward. And so, with that, good government all the time, we are adjourned.